Global Research NewsHour. This is Michel Shostakovsky. Our website is www.globalresearch.ca. This program comes to you from Montreal, Canada. We have joining us from Brussels, prominent author and film director Hanna Albayati. She's a French-Iraqi. She's just returned from a major conference in the Middle East, and we will be discussing issues pertaining to the new Obama administration as to the directions which the Obama administration might be taking with regard to the Middle East, and more specifically with regard to Iraq. Hanna Albayati is very much involved in the debate and discussion on Iraq, and I trust that she will... she is on the line from Brussels. Good morning, good afternoon, Hanna. Good afternoon in Brussels.
Good afternoon, sir.
It's a pleasure to have you again on the program at a very important period, because there's a new president in the United States of America, Barack Obama. Some people believe that this is the end of an era, that it spells promise. I think that we have to have the viewpoint from the Middle East as to how this change has been perceived and what shifts might occur, particularly with regard to Iraq. So that is my broad question.
Well,
Hello? Hello?
Yeah, I'm here. Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you. The line is a bit is not too good, but I can hear you very well.
Okay. Well, from the Middle East, I think at the very start of the campaign there was some hope for change, because anything but Bush was better, but very quickly Trump has proved that very little change is ahead, especially considering the season and the policy of the United States establishment as a whole, which Barack Obama doesn't depart from. We are not very hopeful for significant change. Maybe we can see tactical change in how to deal on the ground with the situation, but not in terms of strategy.
But I have some difficulty in hearing you. I'm not sure whether how it's perhaps just our connection. But Hanna, could you tell us in so many words what might be expected in Iraq itself? Because Barack Obama has made certain statements with regard to Iraq. Namely that there would be troop reductions and that the emphasis would be more in Afghanistan rather than Iraq. How do you, from an Iraqi perspective, how do you view this question?
Well, basically the Iraqis are very united in their stand against the occupation, and they are not waiting only for a troop reduction. They have been calling for years on and years on for the complete and unconditional withdrawal of all occupying forces, including the private mercenaries. Obama has pledged to reduce some troops, which is, again, a tactical change, but not in a significant change in the strategy of the United States. And he has never, ever mentioned the thousands of...
We have to go to commercial break. Hanna, we'll be back with Hanna Albayati just after the break. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Global Research NewsHour. This is Michel Shostakovsky. This program, broadcast out of Houston, Texas, comes to you from Montreal, Canada. Our website is www.globalresearch.ca. we have been experiencing some telephone communications difficulties. Ironically, with the European Union, but we seem to, I think, have resolved that. Our guest on the program is Hanna Albayati, a prominent French-Iraqi activist who has written extensively on the situation in Iraq and is actively involved also in the anti-war movement. And welcome back, Hanna. Can you hear me properly now?
Much better.
Much better. Much better.
Yeah.
Very good. That's amazing. There have been a number of tragic events with the invasion of Gaza, starting just a few days after Christmas, the bombing and subsequent invasion and occupation, with devastating consequences on people's lives. How do you see these events in the broader Middle East context? It would appear that there's been a lot of at least solidarity in the Middle East, but at the same time, the governments such as Egypt, Jordan in particular, well, one can also say Turkey, have been complicit in the actions taken by Israel against the Palestinian people.
Well, I wouldn't say that Turkey is complicit in the sense that Turkey has been very, very vocal from the very start on the Israeli assault and was the only regional government who actually qualified the Israeli actions as war crimes and condemned them very clearly. Then different developments took happened that are very encouraging in the sense of an ongoing movement of unitary protest among Arab masses. It's the first time that so many people have taken to the streets, have also staged strikes, which is quite rare in this region. There is a really broad solidarity movement with Palestine and a consciousness that it's not only a Palestinian question, but it's part of this regional plan to subjugate people. I think this is, in fact, very encouraging because the confederate states like Egypt, Saudi Arabia, have been exposed and cornered. This is a very good development. Of course, the situation in Gaza is horrendous, whether in terms of life loss, the wounded, the civilian capacities, the infrastructure, every single aspect of civilized life has been targeted. So on one side you have a humanitarian disaster completely, but on the other, politically, it's a very interesting development that in fact the resistance option is winning.
Barack Obama has emphasized, I think, during his election campaign, but even more recently, that Israel has, quote, the right to defend itself, without mentioning anything regarding the legal occupation or the fact that this operation is a violation of international law and that people are being killed. How do you view the Obama administration's position, or is it too early? They've named George Mitchell as special envoy to the Middle East. Do you see any shift in U.S. Israeli relations with this new administration?
Well, this is again a proof that there is no real change. But it's not that we are surprised. We don't believe that politics is made by one individual, especially in the case of American politics. There is a very strong establishment. There are lobbies. There are mechanisms. And American establishment has always sided on the side of Israel for the last 50 years, so that's not new. What is unfortunate is that the whole world has been appalled by this last assault. Yeah, this is very new. Usually only the Arabs react to to the Israeli aggression. This time there is consciousness, I feel, everywhere in the world that Israel is a pariah state that respects no law, that has no limit in its aggressivity. And when people voted for Obama for a change, in fact, they will be very disappointed because until now, the whole system in the United States is not willing to change.
How do you view the position of the media? Because I think what you describe is correct. There's been a wave of indignation, including and also in the Jewish communities throughout Europe and North America. But there's also been a certain shift even in the mainstream media. But on balance, if we look at the way the media has behaved, they have been very complicit. I just got a report in from Germany that now they censored some major TV programs and the whole issue of Gaza has been, in a sense, has been pushed aside by the producers and so on, and the same thing is happening if you look at coverage on network television in the United States.
Well, the thing is that conflict zones, because conflicts are waged by imperialist powers and media are hand in hand, they are financed by the same imperialist forces. You don't get a real sense of the conflict zone. But this said, in the Gaza situation, because Palestine until now is not a state, and Gaza had been completely isolated, caged in under a blockade, of course people are appalled by a population that is not even given the chance to flee the bombardment. How can you hide this? Some things went up through the mainstream media that didn't go through in the case of Lebanon, for example, and is never going through in the case of Iraq, because the Palestinian people are a defenseless people who were besieged for so many days with no option to flee. So the Israeli state tried all its best to prevent international media from covering from inside Gaza, but a few television who were inside managed to get some footage out. I have to mention in this occasion that Al Jazeera gave all its footage for free use so as not to silence what was going on under the bombs inside blockaded and caged in Gaza.
Yeah, there's one aspect which I think people in North America and Western Europe are not aware of, because they tend to look at Hamas or Hezbollah as Islamic organizations, but in fact it would appear that that Hamas is also allied with Christians in the Gaza Strip, and the same thing is happening, of course, in Lebanon, where there's a mass unity between Christian and Muslim parties with a view to resisting Israeli invasion, and that, of course, is never mentioned.
I think this does not apply only to Palestine or anywhere people are besieged. Their confessional or their sectarian identities, etc., doesn't mean anything. People are in solidarity under siege. And in Palestine, throughout the years before the creation of Israel, people of so many different confessions used to live in peace with the other. There is no division among the Palestinian population. This is a Western-made propaganda and a Western-instrumentalized division so as Palestinians fight each other, but the population itself, of course, is in solidarity, regardless of their religious affiliation. It's the same case in Iraq, it's the same case in Lebanon. I'm not talking about the puppets that we are appointed as our representatives. The people themselves do not care and actually respect each other's beliefs and each other's ideological affiliation. And in struggle, everybody stands together.
Well, absolutely. I mean, in effect, the Middle East is a region of the world where religions seem to coalesce. At least that was the impression I got when I visited, when I visited Lebanon and visited also Syria. The tremendous integration of religion, because that's where all these religions took birth.
Sure.
I think we have just a couple of minutes before we go to commercial break. With regard turning our attention to Iraq, there is a resistance movement, although most of the media don't accept the fact that there is a resistance movement, and you have been particularly active in promoting the and conceptualizing the Iraqi resistance. We'll have to go to a short commercial break. After the break, we will discuss with Hanna Albayati the nature of the resistance movement in Iraq to foreign occupation. Stay with us.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Welcome back to the Global Research News Hour, which is an initiative of globalresearch.ca, the Center for Research on Globalization, our website, www.globalresearch.ca, Monday through Fridays, 10 Central and 11 Eastern. Hosts are Stephen Lendman and myself occasionally. Our guest today is Hanna Albayati, who joins us from Brussels, and who will give us some insights as to the nature of the Iraqi resistance, invariably depicted by the U.S. media as terrorist organizations, and denying the fact that the entire Iraqi population is behind this resistance. Could you perhaps give us a little bit of background on this question?
Well, it's not only that the Iraqi population is behind the resistance, it's that the entire population is in resistance. Basically, resistance is not a concept, it's a way of life. People cannot all take up weapons. So some people are struggling militarily, some people are struggling completely civilly, and some people politically. It takes many different expressions, from arm to poetry to whatever means you find available to struggle against oppression and occupation. It is the same case as in Gaza. When a people is under occupation, it has the guaranteed right to resist by all means. Inside Iraq, people are resisting for the last 18 years. Under sanctions, they were resisting to give up their rights over their national resources. Nowadays, they are directly facing a military occupation. So the former army has gone underground and is carrying a guerrilla warfare with the help of the youth. And other people are helping this armed movement as much as expressing by their own means their rejection of the occupation. It can mean refusing to collaborate, refusing to work with the occupation. It can mean painting, writing songs. It takes all kinds of shapes, but the entire society rejects the occupation.
But how under those circumstances does the Iraqi, so-called Iraqi government manage to survive? Because there is an Iraqi administration, of course, which was installed by the occupation forces and legitimized in so-called elections. But how does this government manage to survive if the entire population is against it?
This government cannot take to the streets without extreme protection from the occupation itself. This government has no legitimacy and cannot gain any legitimacy. It came in with an alien force that wants to plunder the resources of the very people that they claim to be representing. So this government can only survive with the military protection of the occupation. If the occupation withdraws, this government will dissolve and run outside of the country very quickly. It has really no legitimacy whatsoever. And it has carried so many campaigns against every single town in Iraq in the name of the occupation that now it's even a question of revenge. These people will be forced to flee.
Hannah, what kind of message would you give to people in the United States who are committed to peace and to the withdrawal of occupation forces?
Well, I wish that the people who are committed to peace understand that from the very start this invasion was not in their interest. I think they grasp this feeling, but not to the extent that they understand that everything that results from this illegal act is considered by Iraqis as illegal and null and void. So be it the appointed representatives or the new laws or the new legislation or the so-called reconciliation process, etc., all this is considered null and void completely by the population. I wish they went a step further. Instead of asking just bring the troops home, that they would actually force their government to recognize the people who are capable of negotiating a way out of Iraq, which is the resistance. It's the only force that is capable of representing the interests of the Iraqis, speaking in the interests of the Iraqis, and who could be in a position to discuss a path towards peace between our two nations. So I would ask them to ask for the recognition.
Absolutely, it's the issue of recognition which is at stake. You have pointed out in recent weeks the importance of Venezuela and Bolivia for having broken diplomatic relations with Israel, and what does this imply for Iraq and the recognition of a bogus proxy government installed by occupation forces. We will be taking a short commercial break. This is Michel Chasadovsky, our guest, Hannah Albayati, a prominent author and film director who...
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network because you can handle the truth.
Welcome back to the Global Research News Hour, which comes to you from Montreal. It's an initiative of the Center for Research on Globalization. Our website is www.globalresearch.ca. Our guest today is Hannah Albayati, a prominent French-Iraqi filmmaker and author who joins us from Brussels. Before the commercial break, we were focusing on the issue of the Israeli invasion of Gaza and the curtailment of diplomatic relations by Venezuela and Bolivia with Israel. and the broad implications of this for the struggle in the Middle East. So welcome back, Hannah. How do you view this question? What does it set in terms of a landmark when countries cut off diplomatic relations with Israel?
You know that Mauritania and Qatar also kept their relation. I think it's very important because we need to sanction states who systematically violate international law. And Israel, upon its creation, has not respected any decision made by the United Nations. Not one resolution was respected. It is that time. In fact, it's getting late to start to sanction the actions of these racist states. In the case of Iraq, well, I think we are millions. I'm not the only one who wish that we would reestablish the rule of law internationally. If the invasion is deemed illegal, even by the United Nations Secretary General, then everything that is a consequence of an illegal act remains illegal. And international law, states and individuals have the duty to take every available means to protest ongoing violations of international law. So the first thing would be to withdraw recognition from the appointed illegal government that is pretended to represents the interests of the Iraqi people. These people have no link with their own society and their own population. They have been appointed by an alien occupying power. This population has been developing a very strong movement of resistance, which is a social movement. It has speakers, it has representatives, it has personalities. We should give them a platform at least to voice their demands so that we can see a path for peace. It's very simple.
You mentioned the Secretary General of the United Nations, Ban Ki-moon, I think he is actually in Gaza at this very moment, or he's traveling to Gaza. He has not been particularly vocal, but I think he has been forced to accept the fact that war crimes have been committed. But with regard to Iraq, the United Nations tends to be the United Nations as a body tends to be complicit in the illegal occupation of Iraq.
Completely, of course, and it's prior to the invasion. You know, the United Nations have sustained 13 years of genocidal sanctions on the Iraqi people, and they were very aware of the consequences of the civilian population of Iraq. We cannot make of the United Nations, like we cannot make of entire states, a homogeneous picture. Of course, within the United Nations, you have some bodies who are trying to push for more acceptable norms of international law and how they can work within this framework. For example, the Red Cross has been very vocal against the occupation inside Iraq. The people who are responsible for the displaced are being vocal, but it's very difficult with the current United Nations system of the Security Council and the power of veto to actually get any of this criticism into a different policy. If you look at Gaza these last days, I think one of the most vocal body is the United Nations, not its Secretary General, but the people responsible of UNRWA. They have been bombed. They have been targeted in their ambulances. Their aid program has been burned to the ground. These people have stated very clearly, according to international law, what were the actions of the Israeli state. And sure, there are war crimes. Sure, there are even crimes against humanity because they have the systematic character. And I would even go as far as saying it's an ongoing genocide.
But there you're pointing to a contradiction within the United Nations, because people involved I've worked for the United Nations off and on during my career, but people involved at the grassroots in UN programs are often very committed and are denouncing these war crimes. And then when you get to the Security Council of the United Nations and the Office of the Secretary General of the United Nations, you get another point of view which contradicts the grassroots of UN actions. So in fact, what we need in the UN is some kind of a palace revolution to get rid of the people on the top who are complicit and who are appointees of the United States foreign policy
agenda.
And
the UN is very aware of this. We need a reform of the United Nations. As it stands, the United Nations is an instrument of imperialism because of the Security Council and because of the veto system. And this is a result of World War II. It is not relevant to nowadays politics. Of course it should be reformed, but the entire UN body, I would not say, despite all the dramatic consequences for the people up to now, I would say we should reform it. We should not put it to the bin, because if you throw away the United Nations, then you justify the state of exception, which is what the Bush administration has been trying to impose on the world, that the law is their interest. There is no other law than their own interest. No, we have norms, we have international norms that everybody and every state who is a signatory and a member of the United Nations agrees to, and that should be implemented. And those who do not respect that law should be held accountable. So, of course, we need a real reform of the United Nations before we can count on that body to actually express justice and be on the side of the world community as people.
Absolutely. The United Nations Human Rights Commission has in fact took a stance on Gaza at a much earlier period, if I recall, even before the invasion. UN investigator Richard Falk was refused, or the special rapporteur on human rights was refused access. And that was before they actually started the bombing. So that in effect one sees this, a very contradictory, position on the part of the UN. On the one hand, there is movement in the Palestinian territories of UN officials taking a position barred by Israel. And then on the other hand, the body itself, which is the senior positions in the organization, tend to be mum on taking a position. But you're absolutely right. I mean, we need the UN, but we also need a United Nations which is free of political manipulation by the major powers.
In the recent assault, we stood as Brussels Tribunal. We called for a UNGA resolution under the auspices of 377, which gives the power back to the General Assembly. It's a special mechanism saying that when the Security Council fails, for whatever reasons, to come to agreement or systematically uses its veto to stop an ongoing aggression, then the United Nations General Assembly has the right to convene and to issue a resolution. I think this should be very supported by everyone. It's a way to dispossess this Security Council that has been ensuring a status quo with its allies of ongoing aggression against the people of the South, and this should be fought actively through whatever mechanism exists from within the United Nations and outside the United Nations.
You were recently in a major forum which was held in Beirut, and to which several prominent people attended, including Cynthia McKinney, I believe, and also former U.S. Attorney General Ramsey Clark. Was he not present as well at this conference?
He was.
Yeah.
He was.
What was the result of this? Because it was actually taking place at the height of the bombing. I saw several reports on it. How do you view it, that what results were achieved?
Well, I think me personally, as an activist, I'm a little tired of gatherings and conferences. But considering that it was held in Beirut at that specific time, and the declaration that came out of it is quite good in asking the world to really continue, in fact, to re-recognize the right of occupied people to resistance, which is the main point. Basically, so many people are being besieged, and it's as if we forgot what was the Europeans' own struggle 50 years ago. There is a resistance in the Arab world. It's the same resistance that people were using when Nazi Germany was trying to subjugate others, and we defended the resistance at the time. Actually, we said no, never again, you know. So we actually have to uphold this right, which is a guaranteed right. Then we also have to protect the people who are not themselves carrying weapons, but who want to support the people who do. So nowadays, the people who stand in solidarity with resistance movements, even if they are 3,000 kilometers away from the conflict zone, are being criminalized. There are basic principles that we should defend. The declaration of the Beirut Conference in that sense is helpful. It calls also for the solidarity of the three resistance, the Iraqi, the Lebanese, and the Palestinian. There are many aspects to it in terms of respect of the environment, because, you know, like whether be it the American occupation or the Israeli army, they use unconventional weapons who are polluting the Arab land for decades. We are not only talking about global warming, we are talking about completely polluting rivers and crops for decades, for people who are already under siege. I cannot define every point of the declaration, but it was a success, and it was a success in the sense that I think the participants from outside the Arab world who came to attend the conference felt that it was a social movement. The entire nation is behind the people who are in struggle. People like what you call the moderate Arabs are completely discredited. They stood during the siege, during the killing, with the enemy. It is a real scandal. They should be actually tried along with the Israelis for complicity in war crimes.
The issue that you raised with regard to resistance, I think it's important to point out that during World War II, many countries, including the United States, supported the French resistance, La Résistance. They also supported, there were resistance movements in Greece. It was the Greek resistance. There was an Italian resistance. There were the Yugoslav partisans. Why is it that during World War II, the West, let's say North America and Britain and so on, supported the resistance movements, and now, well, of course, I know the answer to that question. They're the occupation forces. But as far as public opinion is concerned, the Iraqi resistance is very similar to the French resistance opposing the invasion of the homeland, their country, by foreign forces.
You know, there is a very big machine behind the occupation of Iraq. It's not only the military. There's a very big war propaganda, and there's a process of dehumanization of the Iraqi that is going on for 18 years. It's not only upon 2003. So by now, the public opinion doesn't understand that an Iraqi is a human being, and as much as the public opinion has difficulty to understand that a Palestinian is a human being. I sound a little angry by saying this, because I find it systematic. It's as if history, you know, repeats itself forever and the human never learn whatever. Basically, people are besieged, and of course they will react to this assault. Then we dehumanize them by whatever means, as if they were barbarians, you know, as if they were increasingly violent. Whereas, in fact, these people were peaceful, and we are a culture, I'm talking as a Westerner now, we are a culture that solves every problem by force.
Yeah, absolutely.
So we reverse it.
Yeah. Absolutely, but there's also in the media this idea that ultimately the Western so-called civilization is superior, that we are more knowledgeable, and so on and so forth.
This is completely assumed. It's a colonial culture, but I don't want to criminalize the people. What I want to point out to the people is that until now, nobody has made one investigation, not the government, not the Iraqi so-called government, not the occupation, not the United Nations, nobody on who is behind the attacks against civilians. The Iraqi resistance has the popular support. If it has the popular support, I doubt that it is killing the civilians that it needs to operate. So my question is, who is behind the attacks on civilians, and how come no investigation is carried out and nobody has been brought to trial in regards to these kind of killings? And how come the international community assumes that it's the Iraqi resistance who is killing its own people? This is ridiculous.
We'll have to go to a break. I think this is a very crucial issue, because there have been some reports indicating that, in fact, the civilian deaths are due to paramilitary organized by the occupation forces and the Iraqi proxy government. Stay with us. We'll be back after the break. Welcome back to the Global Research News Hour. This is an initiative of the Center for Research on Globalization based in Montreal. Our guest is Hanna Al-Bayati, who joins us from Brussels, a prominent French-Iraqi author and film director, very active in the anti-war movement. We were discussing before the break the nature of the Iraqi resistance and the portrayal by the Western media, the distortions, but also the fact that they are in Iraq paramilitary groups involved in the killings of civilians, and the media casually describes these groups as part of the Iraqi insurgency. The question is, who is behind these paramilitary groups? Certainly not, as Hanna pointed out, certainly not the Iraqi resistance, which represents the Iraqi people. Anna?
Yeah. Hello? Yeah. Sorry. Yeah. I'm here. The problem that we face a problem under occupation, and considering that the Americans have completely sealed the country out of sight, I cannot myself say who is behind. I can point up to historical similarities, because I cannot myself investigate on the ground. But we have prior knowledge of American policy in Latin America. It's usually called the Salvador option. So we suspect that it's mainly financed by the United States directly, that they are trained, organized, and armed by the American occupation. And they operate as death squads under the protection of the Americans. It seems obvious to every Iraqi who is living under occupation. Because I will be attacked legally to prove, and that I cannot prove being outside Iraq, I will not go as far as saying, yes, it's the Americans, but of course I have all kinds of suspicion it's the Americans, and it serves only the American interests. So I don't see who else could be behind this kind of attacks. At least if it's not made directly by the American hands, it's at least orchestrated by the Americans. This is sure.
Well, but we had some very specific cases, for instance, in Basra, where the Iraqi police, which had arrested two terrorists, who turned out to be British special forces, and they were disguised as Arabs with moustaches, and they were going to the center of Basra with a car loaded with bombs, and they were arrested. And it's that incident suggests that, in fact, occupation, in this case it was British forces, were directly involved in suicide operations or bombings in major urban areas.
Sure. We also have many eyewitnesses of people saying that they are being stopped at checkpoints by the American military, taken into custody for interrogation, and on their way back, the car explodes by remote control in the middle of a populated civilian area. So the car has been, I don't know how you say, the bomb has been fixed to the car while they were being interrogated in custody. They are not aware that they are carrying the bomb. We have many kinds of eyewitnesses of this allegation.
Coming to the end of the program, Hannah, unfortunately, we'll have to say goodbye. Our guest, Hannah Albayati, and our thanks to her.
Long live Palestine!
Long live Palestine! And, long live America, peace in America, peaceful America.
Peaceful and peaceful world. Thank you, Michelle, for having me.
Yes, thank you, Hannah.